This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
And we are live. And hello to Suzanne Slade.
Well, good morning, Mel.
Okay, I'm here in Israel, and it's late afternoon here. You are somewhere in the hills of New Hampshire.
Correct.
And it's morning by you, afternoon by me. I should say, because I'm in Israel and we have a horrific war going on, there's always a chance of having air raid sirens, in which case I will disappear for 10 minutes, but then I'll be back and we will continue as if nothing happened. Suzanne, I don't know where to begin. 170, 180 children's books?
Yeah, well, this has been my full-time job for, I'm coming up on 30 years. So they add up. And a lot of them were what's called work for hire books. Those were early in my career. And it, you know, that kind of a book you would get assigned a series of six. And you've got deadlines every 2 weeks. So those can come out pretty quickly as opposed to the trade books, which is what I do now, which, as you know, is a much longer process of research, editing, finding a home, more editing.
We're going to talk about all of that. And I want to speak briefly about your three books from this past year, which are incredible. I've read them all. But we want to dedicate most of our conversation to George Gershwin in your marvelous book of, I don't know, about 8 years ago, award-winning, multi-award-winning book. And it's called, I have it here, The Music in George's Head. It's a brilliant, gorgeous book. And so one second. So that's because of the centenary of Rhapsody in Blue. So let's talk about the three books that you just published.
Okay, well, I have them here because we authors love to hold up our books, don't we?
So, as you should, yeah.
I've got one called Behold the Octopus, which, as you can tell, has gorgeous illustrations. The reviewers have really talked a lot about the illustrations, but which are by Tom Gonzalez. We've done a couple books together, but it's, I really, this one was fun because the main text is very brief. It's a lyrical brief text. But then describing the actions of an octopus, the wonderful things they can do. But then there's more information and each in sidebars, and then each spread features a different octopus because there are hundreds of beautiful creatures.
The plural of octopuses is octopi or octopuses.
Okay, you're the biologist, Mel. I think it's octopi. I think you can use both.
I'm a microbiologist. Octopuses, octopi are way too big for me. Yeah, way too big. And I was going to say, octopuses are nice if you're not being eaten by them.
Right, they rarely do that.
They are, but they are carnivores.
Oh, yes, they're carnivores. They're hunters. They know how, some species know how to use tools, rocks and things. They build dens. They're very smart. I don't know if you've ever seen, you know, YouTube has all kinds of videos of octopus, and they're so smart. And sometimes they're on a boat, and there's one video where they're squeezing through a little, they can squeeze their whole body, even their head, they can shrink it down. They're amazing, incredible, very fascinating. And the way they can change their color and shape, they can imitate other animals.
Yeah, so. I've worried about that frequently. And is it? Can you just show a double spread of the book?
Oh yes,
gorgeous book.
It is.
Suzanne, some of the people are watching us. Some of the people are listening to the podcast. And I was so excited to introduce you that I forgot to say who I am. Yes, look how beautiful this is.
That's the blanket octopus. That's they can use that to scare off predators. They're big blankets.
Go ahead and read it. It's a blanket octopus?
Yes. Well, what might be fun is just a quick intro of, you can get a rhythm of how the text goes, how brief it is. Amazing octopus, 8 long arms swirl and curl through salty seas, hunting. So then there's one word per spread, along with, again, the sidebar information that talks about how they hunt, you know, building, gliding, my lovely gliding blanket octopus, changing, and then hiding. Grasping, hiding. So there's some rhyme in there, but one word is driving each spread, which is kind of a unique. I'm usually quite wordy in my books. So this was a different kind of a process for me.
That's wonderful. That's a great book. And of course, if you want to delve into the nitty gritty, you have the sidebars.
And back matter. I've been known as the back matter queen. Actually, at one publisher, I sparked a whole back matter meeting because I had so much back matter that they had to discuss what makes sense. But teachers and students really love that. I mean, if a reader doesn't care to delve into all of that or only some of it, it's fine. But if someone really wants to go nuts, and I don't know, there's always too much, as you know, as an author, you know, I always say I research this much about my subject and I can put this much in a picture book. So I try to squeak in as much of the rest of the good stuff in the back matter as I can.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not a back matter a queen or king. I add back matter when I'm forced to. But that's okay. So let's before we segue on to your next book that just came out, I forgot to say who I am. So I'm Mel Rosenberg, and I am the host of the Children's Literature Channel of the New Books Network. And that is why I'm here with the wonderful multi author, Suzanne Slade. So now you had a book that just came out this month with Sleeping Bear.
Oh, yes, yes.
We should name the publisher. Is that a copy of the book, the octopus one?
The octopus is Peachtree.
Peachtree.
And we've got Behold the Hummingbird is coming out in April, a sequel, if you will.
Okay.
This one, Some Days Are Yellow, that just came out in April. This is Sleeping Bear Press.
I love it.
They do gorgeous books.
Who edited this?
This is Barb McNally.
I love Sleeping Bear. They're excellent.
I do too. And, their books are beautiful.
And this is such a lyrical Suzanne.
Yeah.
And the illustrations are marvelous.
Yeah. The illustrator, Michelle Lee, she also illustrated a book that came out this year by George Takei. I don't know if I'm saying his last name right. From Star Trek. If that, I'm not a Trekkie, but
I'm not going to correct you.
he had a wonderful children's book out. So Michelle also illustrated his. But this book is kind of fun because it highlights how days are different, you know, how, as we all know, as on this journey of life. And some days, you know, just you think are going to be great. Some days have these surprises that are really fun or not so fun. And this book kind of addresses those types of ups and downs of all everyday life. And at the end, you know, as you're always thinking, what's my ending? What's the big finish? Which is that every, you know, tomorrow's brand new. So no matter if you had a fantastic today or not so great today, tomorrow's brand new and it's all new and you don't know what adventures are coming. So that was, I really enjoyed working on that book.
Please, Suzanne, read a bit of it. It's so lyrical. It's gorgeous. And I must say, there's lots of books on the same genre, but
correct.
But you found such a voice here. Read a little bit.
Okay. So we start out, some days are yellow, others feel blue. Some days are me, others more you.
Read the dessert one.
Oh, you want the dessert one. All right. He's got something. All right. Let's see if I can get there. I think I'm this lead. So some days take thinking. This is so cute how this child, of course, is the engineer in me loves that they're drawing up this birdhouse and treehouse. And others need heart. And here we have a little bird. Actually, a friend of mine, she just was saying she was reading it to her grandchild and they had so many questions. What happened to the bird? Some days take thinking, others need heart. Oh, some days are fast, others seem slow. Some days are yes, others all no. We've all had the no days. Here we go. Some days are rain, others clear sky. Here comes what you wanted. Some days are spinach.
Some days are spinach, others
cream pie.
I love it. I'm personally a lemon meringue pie guy. But
buddy,
I
love pie so much I couldn't even begin to pick a favorite. I think pie could be my favorite food group, really. So
we need a book on pie.
Ooh.
How about a book on pie and pie?
Oh, 3.14159.
Yes.
Dude.
And the pie.
And there's Pie Day, which would be a big day to promote the book. Maybe you and I are going to do that together, Mel.
I would be honored.
Okay. All right. We will be workshopping that when we're done here.
Okay. So Suzanne, now the book on Vera Rubin, do you have it with you?
And there she is. Yes. This is a beautiful, this is a Calkins Creek.
You came out of nowhere. Came out of the dark.
Yes. Shining star. Vera Rubin discovers dark matter. And I have a mechanical engineering degree. So I am official, you know, woman in STEM. So one of my favorite subjects is to write about other women who just made phenomenal discoveries, Vera Rubin being one of them. And this is where, as we were discussing back matter, I really, not to shortcut the storyline, but I can show you an example of where. So I get to do my author's note, right, and write more about Vera and include actual photos of her as a child or young woman using various telescopes, because I love using actual photos. Although the illustrations are just phenomenal, there's nothing like seeing the person, for the child to see the person. This is Vera, and a timeline is always lovely to, but just more about it, you know, everything. And I always talk to experts when I write the nonfiction. So I get to acknowledge these, you know, very smart people who help me out. So that's, back matter is always a fun thing for me.
At least for one of us. I was a scientist for, I don't know, 35 years or something. It's like the nonfiction, I interview a lot of nonfiction people. By the way, Laurie Wallmark must be a friend and competitor of yours.
Not a competitor, but a good friend. And yeah, we met up at an NSTA, National Science Teacher Association.
And I've had lots of
You had Melissa Stewart.
Melissa Stewart. Jen Swanson and many others. I'm forgetting.
And Jennifer Byrne.
Jennifer Byrne, of course, who introduced us. Yes.
And her book on Einstein. Yeah.
and how the sea came to be. Brilliant. But this is about you now. And so I was just saying that, you know, after so many years of trying to be a nonfiction guy, I want to be a fiction guy now. And so seeing your work and how you're able to morph and segue from one to another is really special. So just a few more words on this book, who published it, and
The Shining Star with Calkins. Yes.
Yes.
And the illustration, Susan Reagan, I do have to, and not only are they beautiful, but you would be surprised maybe to know the amount of research the illustrators do on these types of projects. And I will also do, you know, I will be looking for anything that's historically inaccurate on a drawing and, you know, on say this large telescope that she used. And so it's quite a balancing act, I think, when we're creating these nonfiction books, that they're so gorgeous, but yet factually we really go over every detail of the illustrations here, the type of scope and where it was, and the experts help as well with that. But I'm in awe of illustrators like Susan, who can just, they're just drop dead gorgeous to look at. Yet for anyone who knows about the science behind it, they can see that they're actually accurate illustrations as well.
And she fought fiercely, as many female scientists did, to achieve her fame and glory. And then at the end of the day, she didn't get a Nobel Prize.
No, yeah. Here's a woman who, early on in her career, women weren't allowed to use some of the big telescopes, and she finally, as you said, had to fight her way there. Had to, you know, took not only like a woman like Vera, very bright, very self-motivated, works hard in her field, but then has to contend with these other obstacles placed in her way. She, the one observatory, there was no women's restroom. So she makes a sign, draws a little stick figure of a woman, sticks it on the door, you know, and that just had to be a lot of challenges to overcome. And yeah, and then she discovers all this evidence for dark matter, which is huge. And yeah, was not recognized with a Nobel Prize, which many thought she should be at that time.
And initially, people said, "Oh, this is bullshit," which right. Very often happens when you discover something. She reminds me of Rosie Franklin, who also was Jewish, who was also denied a Nobel Prize, It's very sad, but your book is gorgeous, congratulations. Now let's talk about Suzanne and how you got to Gershwin.
How I got to Gershwin.
So excuse me. I have an octopus in my throat.
That's okay. Well, I'll tell you, Mel. I will always say, students ask, you know, where do you get your book ideas? And I never go looking for book ideas. They always find me. And George Gershwin found me on July 4th, let's say 10 years ago-ish. And I was home. I was watching our local PBS, Chicago PBS channel. And they had a 4th of July, they were showing fireworks and things. And in the background, Rhapsody in Blue was playing. It was just lovely, right? And then the narrators start talking about how George had written the song specifically for this event that Paul Whiteman, a band leader, was put on, called An Experiment in Music in New York. And it was to be this wild, crazy new kind of music, this weird thing called jazz that a lot of musicians were saying wasn't real music, you know. Well, anyway, they're talking about he wrote it for that. And then his first performance was 1924, 100 years ago.
Exactly, 100 years ago, 2 weeks ago.
In New York, Aeolian Hall. But George, with this pressure of you need to write a piece for this particular event on this particular day, there was some stress behind that, and he was struggling to come up with something. But he started hearing sounds like he got on a train, And it's the book of the rattledy bang, rattledy bang, rattledy bang of the train that got him. And all of a sudden he could see and hear this composition. But the part that really struck me was when he went to perform this. Okay, it's finally the big performance. All these musicians have all their sheet music that they're following. But George has no sheet music in front of him on his piano. He is just playing, as the book alludes, the notes in his head. So I just thought, number one, the song, of course, is so iconic and is so, I don't even know words to describe it. It's, as I think you said in your email, changed your life, Mel.
It did.
You know, it's so the song itself, and just to hear the background, I thought a book about how that composition, how he wrote that composition, and then of course the big finish is him performing it at this big experiment in music concert. The people in the audience are falling asleep. He's almost at the end. He's the next to last performer. People are falling asleep, literally in their seats. Some are getting up to leave. They sit down and that first, you know, and everyone's like, what is happening? And music history was made right then and there.
And so on.
Lovely.
Yes. So, you know, I grew up with Rhapsody in Blue, and even I didn't know, and I learned from your book about this clarinet player that who as a kind of a lark, did this. And I thought Gershwin had written that in, and there you go.
Yeah. And as soon as Gershwin heard it, he said, we're keeping that in there. You know, just how this piece was so fluid, really, because that was at the rehearsal right before the concert. So it was always in flow. I mean, then for him to sit down, and I wonder if each time he performed it, it was a little, his part anyway, was a little different. I don't know that for sure, but one would wonder if he's not using music.
It's a gorgeous book. You don't happen to have it on hand because it's in Chicago.
Right. But there's a lovely reading, as I sent the link to you, the Chicago.
Yes, I know, but I want people to buy the book. It's still available, right?
Oh, yes.
It's a gorgeous book in blues and browns and sepia. And to talk about the illustrator for a minute. It's a genius book. The words and the illustrations, I've never seen anything like it, how they blend, or I should say, I've never seen anything like that where the author is not the illustrator.
Yeah. Stacy Innerst was the fantastic illustrator. And he is a musician as well, which was certainly a bonus. You know, the art directors often try to pair up someone who has some kind of a background. And so he was the perfect illustrator for this project. And he, as you say, Mel, created palettes of blue. See, I'm not an artist. I may not use the right artistic words, but it's in blue tones, which is just incredible. And then there are words in the text where I talk about when George was young, you know, classical jazz, the blues, and those words are put in a certain kind of a handwritten font type, which I had done something similar in the manuscript. In the manuscript, I had put each of those in a different color and font. And then in mine, I combined them to make Rhapsody in Blue, the letters. It was kind of a weird thing.
So Stacy
took that kernel of an idea and made it much, much better. Yeah.
So you saw this, show on PBS, and you hadn't grown up on Rhapsody in Blue as I did. And you said, I have to write a book about this.
Yeah, exactly.
But are you a musician?
Well, I play piano. I was in choirs, but
Wonderful. I thought you were an engineer. So now is a good, I want to segue now into Suzanne's life. So now we're going to go back to the age of zero. Run us through Suzanne. You became a mechanical engineer, worked on all kinds of cool systems.
Yeah.
And then gave it up.
Well, basically, I just always liked math. You know, I'm the older I get, the more I really recognize the the influence of genes, the gene pool that we receive at Suzanne at age zero. And for whatever reason, I seem to get a math science gene. And even in first
grade. Well, why do you say that? I looked at your website. You were writing books from the age of six, dear.
Yeah. When the teacher.
Good thing I reminded you.
Yes, I did. When my teacher in first grade, that was my first story. She said, what would you do if you found a candy tree, a tree that grows candy? And oh, buddy, I had a lot to say about that, but a lot of misspelled words. Basically, my story was about not telling my brother and sister because they would get too many cavities. I think it was a bit of a worry wart. But that said, that was first grade. But what I was doing most of the time in first grade, because my teacher, Miss Hudson, it was her first year as a teacher, and I mean, she might not have been as structured as other teachers. I loved her. I would take my math book and I would go and sit in the coat closet and I would do my math book, because it was the back, you know, when you could write in the book. And then I finished the book and I said to her, oh, I finished this. And she goes, oh, here's the second grade math book. So I went back in the coat closet and I finished that. And I said, oh, I'm done with this. She goes, okay, here's the third grade math book. But that's the age where you get to the book that you can't write in, that you have the problems in the book and you put the answers on a piece of paper. And when you're in first grade, I was like, I don't get it. So then she wrote a letter home to my mother and said, Suzanne will now be a math helper for the rest of the year because she's finished the two books and doesn't like the third grade book with them. But anyway, I have to admit, writing was my least favorite subject all through school, through high school. I was a big reader, huge reader, but writing to me felt very gray, if you will. Like when I would do in physics or chemistry or whatever in high school, if the answer was 4.79 millimeters, you even know how many significant digits, right? That is the answer. And it's very clean. It's very definite. It's very neat. They would say, write a paper on the theme of this book. Well, I'd go, ooh, I could write this or I could write this. And my younger brain was like, I don't know what's right. And that bothered me. So, and now as a writer, which I do love writing now, that just shows how as we grow older, right, we change. I still love math and science, but this is something that I love using the creative side of my brain. As you said, you're liking switching from the nonfiction to the fiction. Since I did not have writing in much in high school or college, in engineering and college, you don't take any writing classes. I had a lot to learn. So I went back to college at night as a young mother. I was a stay-at-home mom and I took a class on writing books for children. And I had
you became a mechanical engineer, and we all know how difficult these studies are. Where did you study?
Valparaiso University. It's in Indiana.
You have to study all kinds of things: Fourier transformations,
fluid dynamics,
electricity, electronics,
calculus, differential equations, thermodynamics.
The Jews say "Oy vey."
No, I enjoyed it.
People are different, right? I can't say I enjoyed it. I used it afterwards, but I didn't enjoy it while I was studying it. And good for you. And then you actually became a mechanical engineer and you worked on spaceships and I don't know what.
Worked on rockets out in California. I worked for McDonnell Douglas Space Systems. I worked on Delta Titan rockets, Delta Star spacecraft. And then I moved into the automotive field and I worked on brake boosters, the things that make your car stop, as I tell kids at school visits. And I enjoyed that. I think I like challenges. I like learning new things. And I was, and that's kind of when you're an engineer, you become a mechanical or electrical or whatever. You learn the basic principles and classes. But then when you get into your job, you have to learn the specifics of whatever field or vehicle or whatever area you're in, automotive, aerospace, whatever it might be.
I'm in awe, Suzanne, and you gave all this up for fun. So how did you make the transition from being serious to being less serious?
Well, the transition came in one July when we adopted a 3-day-old baby girl and I became a mother. And then about 12 months later, I gave birth to our son. So now I'm a busy mom. And I decided I would stay home and take care of my children. And then as I'm reading them, stacks and stacks of picture books, which has always been my favorite genre of children's books. And when I was young, I would join the summer reading club at the local library and I would take home as many books as I could carry. And so reading to them, and I thought, oh, wouldn't that be fun to write children's picture books? Having no idea what mountain lie ahead. But the journey began, and it was slow, as it is for, you know, many authors. And so classes, conferences, joined SCBWI, and it took 8 years to get my first book contract.
Hold on a second. So one of the things, most of the people that I speak to, and this is also my story, went to SCBWI and like the world opened. And I said, okay, there is a path. Because, you know, we went to university, we got degrees. You want to be a mechanical engineer, you study mechanical engineering.
Right.
Very few universities, I don't know if any, have a bachelor's degree in writing children's books. They have master's, but not bachelor's degree. So this was the revelation for me. You know, there is a path. There are things you can study. I didn't know that until I was quite old.
Right. It is. Becoming an author is not a traditional path because, yeah, you could get an English degree, a journalism degree, but to be an author, it's your own path. You have to be motivated. You have to not get discouraged. You have to keep being willing to learn and to,
But in picture books, you can, you know, I feel that I could have had a degree by now in picture books, if there were such a thing. So much to learn.
So much to learn. And you know, for non-writers though, like you, the best written picture book, you pick it up and you read it and it flows so well that you would say, boy, this would be easy to write. That's the mark of a good book. But what appears to be the easiest to write was actually probably just painstakingly, you know, it's such a slow process.
Yeah. So how did you, after 8 years, get your first book published? How did you find an agent? How did you break in? The people who write picture books that are traditionally published are 1 in 1,000, 1 in 5,000. And people like you who have gone on to have many, many wonderful books published and won awards as you have are like 1 in 1,000,000.
Well, yeah, I think I've heard. Well,
how did that happen, Suzanne?
Okay, so how it happened, I told you about the class at night, the SCBWI, the conferences, all of that. I joined several critique groups. So I'm slogging along for 8 years. And it's just been the slowest, it's just been incremental. Writing gets a little better, learn a little more, gets a little better. And I went from, this is back in the days when every submission got a rejection letter. You know, nowadays it's the policy is kind of like, if you don't hear from us, you know, but back in the day, I was getting the dear author, thank you for your story. We don't want it. Okay. Then I started getting the dear Suzanne, thank you for sending us The Inventor's Secret. It was really nice, but we don't want it. Then I got, dear Suzanne, thank you for sending whatever. Would you consider revising a little and sending it back to us? I could see. So each of these steps to me was a big win, was a big encouragement.
Wow. Yeah, for sure. And were you working with a critique group?
Yeah, I had several critique groups. I didn't have an agent for many, many years. So I broke in on my own. So my first... We talked about early on the work for hires. While I was working on my picture books, I also had become very aware of the straight up nonfiction books. You know, you see in the children's summer photo illustrated, summer illustrations. And all of a sudden it kind of clicked with me. I thought, now I have this science background. What if I tried to leverage that? And I'm fascinated by science topics and write up some samples, which I did, sent them to the work for hires and said, listen, I have this engineering degree. I'd be happy to write on any of your upcoming topics. And that became my breakthrough, was a series of 6 books on atoms, chemical reactions, the periodic table. These were page turners, I'm telling you. So that was breaking in. And so I started doing a great deal of the work for hire.
This was unagented still?
Yes. Yeah. And they liked my work. So they kept giving me more and more. I think 1 year I wrote like 32 books in a year. It got very busy. And then I got picked up by another work for hire. They were having me do biographies, which was really fascinating. And as I'm doing this, my writing, I'm learning more about research, about writing, about working with an editor, those types of books, you're looking at word level, you know, to keep to a certain reading level, word count. But all of that was very helpful. And I learned about different people and subjects. And I started getting other ideas for topics to write in my trade picture books. And then finally broke in with a smaller publisher. Arbordale was my first trade book sale.
Also without an agent.
Without an agent. And then I think I got a book with Charles Bridge, then with Peachtree, just kind of Calkins Creek.
Unagented.
Correct. Yeah. My mantra became, write something so good that when they find it in that slush pile, they're going to take notice. My job, I have to write something that they cannot, that stops them and they will. So,
Suzanne, I was thinking about that this morning, that in order to break in, you have to write better than what they have because you're not a name. You know,
right.
The people I'm interviewing like you, okay? You're a name, Suzanne Slate. And for people who are in the process of breaking in, they actually have to write books that are at least as good as yours so that they'll be noticed.
And you think I have a name, I don't know, but I still get plenty of rejections and I still need to really, I have to have a very compelling, interesting subject that young readers, you know, and I have to write in a way that's really clever and with a thread draws people in, that's very engaging. It has to be factually correct. People say, I've had friends who are not in the business say, oh, now they'll just buy. I said, no, but I did feel that it was almost a good thing. I think it was a good thing when I was early on. I was like, I would just tell myself, this has to sparkle, shine and do everything so that when that, whatever editor finds it in that slush pile, they're going to be like, whoa, this is really interesting. You know, I've got to really catch their attention.
Which manuscript was this?
Well, the very first with trade was Animals Are Sleeping. And that was with Arbordale. It was just a, you know, a little lyrical. Then there were just other, the Gershwin one was my first one with Calkins. And that was unagented. Course, finding these fascinating people like George Gershwin who do these amazing things, they're the ones bringing all the sparkle and shine. And I just have to present it in a way that's engaging and clear for young readers.
Well, what I love about your Gershwin book is it's not only about George Gershwin. It's not like only a biography. It's just as much about his music and about the story of Rhapsody in Blue.
Yeah. Yes. That's because that's the thing you can find, especially when you're writing biographies, is I'll stumble upon someone like, okay, I first have to see, are there any books about this person? If not, like I have a book about the Harlem Globetrotters. That was another PBS special. Now, I would have thought for sure there were books about the Globetrotters, and there weren't. I was stunned. So then I can really tell the story that I feel should be told about, you know. But if there is a book about someone, you have to say, how can I do something different or unique that brings another aspect to this person's life that the existing books did not?
But you have a Dolly Parton book, Dazzling Dolly, yes. And there's other, I don't know if I should be the one to tell you, but there's other picture books on Dolly Parton.
Well, here's the other thing about the pipeline of children's picture books. When I wrote and sold the Dolly Parton book, there were no other picture books about Dolly. So as you know, there's a picture book on average is kind of 3 years in the works. Maybe the Dolly Parton one, I think we were able to get out in two, but but they're like the book that I wrote about her, I was very captivated by the fact that she had stage fright as a young girl. Who would have thought, I mean, Dolly, who's just was wearing a cowboy's bikini outfit at a football halftime show she did would have had stage fright. But I thought that was and something that children today could relate to. And it could. So I focused on that aspect of her life. And that was a struggle she had to overcome. But she had such passion for singing. She had to overcome that to pursue her dream. So different books share maybe different facets of a person's life.
Incredible. So how did you find Karen Fox? You're a wonderful agent.
Yes, she's very wonderful. In SCBWI in the Chicago area where I live part of the year, I was on a committee every year that put out a conference called Prairie Writers and Illustrators Day. It's in November. And it's a one day, but it is a long, big, full pack day. But Karen was one of the agents we had as a speaker. And we just happened to sit next to each other at a meal and then another meal. And we were just talking. And that kind of organically happened. Yeah.
And you already had a couple of books.
Yeah, I think I had worked with at least, I don't know, 7-8 houses at that point. Yeah. Each one was a slow, you know, getting into sometimes. Fortunately, to live near Chicago, there were a lot of the big book shows that would happen down at McCormick Place. And before I was published, I would go to those and I would go to the different publishers' booths and meet and, you know, I might meet an editor, I might not. But I remember meeting Kathy Landwehr from Peachtree. And she had looked at the Gershwin book, I believe, at that point. But anyway, then we had met face to face, you know, some of things like that. If they've seen your work and like it, and then they meet you, there's more of a connection maybe on the next story.
Yeah, but you know, Suzanne, after your initial sales, you know, Charles Bridge, we could have found an agent at that juncture.
I tried and I...
Really?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. No, it's, you know, agents are very busy people and they can only take on so many people. And yeah, but I do feel like that made me, I had to really hustle and work and find these editors and I would customize each query, you know, each cover letter with each submission for that editor. If I'd met them somewhere, if they'd considered, they'd made a nice comment on a previous story of mine, I always tried to connect with the editors in that way.
So coming back to now, what really interests me is, I mean, everything about your writing interests me. The so-called dichotomy between the nonfiction STEM and the fiction and, you know, writing and some of the people I interview whom I love, you know, they want to write biographies that are real nonfiction. They don't want to put words into the mouths of dead people that they might not have said. And then there's people like me who say, write a good story, semi-fiction, nonfiction, informational circus fiction. It's the story, folks. Correct me, please.
Well, if I'm writing a biography, a nonfiction biography, I am only going to share facts. But the trick, I will not put words. I do have dialogue, but I found it. So if there's dialogue, if there's quotation marks around something, I found it and I've got the source in the back to show readers where it came from. That's the way I roll. Other authors will do it differently and that gives them more freedom, you know, to add, you know, but it's all fact. But the trick is what I try to do is take these very compelling, interesting facts, but then as I'm presenting them, I try to do it. I've had people say, oh, your book is fiction about, they think it's fiction. And that's is very complimentary to me that it reads like fiction. But I'll say, well, it's not fiction because everything in there is true. But the way it's presented, like in the Gershwin book, I think, I don't know why this came to mind, but as people are rushing into Aeolian Hall to hear that big concert that George's been working on his composition for, I said something like, hurried feet pound out staccato beats as they're going into the hall.
I love that.
And I think that kind of reads like fiction. It feels fun. And it also has that musical. We've got staccato, so we're talking musical. But that's nonfiction. People were in a hurry. It was cold. They were running inside. But instead of saying people hurried in, I try to find some lyrical, clever, whatever words that make it feel like you said it's about story.
It's lyrical nonfiction. I love it. Betsy Bird, we need a new category. Lyrical nonfiction. For us Jews, you know, keeping kosher and keeping almost kosher.
Keep us kosher here, Mel.
We can have a discussion, but we don't know each other well enough because, you know, as I said, well, let's have a little bit of this discussion. Okay, so George Gershwin was a very complicated person.
Yes.
Okay, and you can write a nonfiction story that will have only things he said and only things he did, but it won't have all the things he said or did or thought.
Correct.
And then we get into, how I feel as a scientist that scientists pursue singular truths, but truth is a very complicated thing. And I applaud you, and I applaud my other colleagues and friends who when they write nonfiction, you know, they write nonfiction. But it doesn't really bother me, right? If they're writing about somebody who burps at the dinner table and might have not have burped that same evening, it doesn't bother me that much. And it's nice that it bothers you. I like that.
Well, different. Yeah, I think every writer has a different style. And also, I know the editors, the main editors that I've worked with, and I know that they would also not want to put in something that hadn't happened. I think I have one, where I had to kind of put a disclaimer where I said, you were just saying about what a book could say, what George Gershwin said. In that example, there was very little primary source of any dialogue or George's own personal writings because I wanted to put more quotes in than I was able to. So some people, there just simply is not that information available. Then other people like Vera Rubin, she wrote a book about her life, wonderful book. So I had so much material to look at, and she did interviews. I watched all these different interviews she did. So I had so many quotes, reams of material, but Gershwin there, that did not exist. And if it wasn't recorded, then it will never exist. So we have some people, you have a lot to work with, some you have a little, and I don't know what rabbit hole I went down, but where were we on this topic?
We're talking about what you've done, which is strictly kosher nonfiction, and right. you cited Gershwin based on an interview that he had in the early 1930s.
Yes.
So it's all verbatim according to this, and I think it's lovely. But I'm saying just me. I really don't care if the author takes a few liberties, as long as it's clear to the reader,
yeah,
that he might not have burped on that particular evening.
Well, and I've seen that sometimes in a subtitle it'll say like the mostly true story of so and so, and then in the author's note they'll give
Does that bother you?
No. And then there's a disclaimer, and I can't remember which book I did the disclaimer in, which said no one knows, we don't know. So I did have to make some. I don't know if it was Susan and Frederick, which was about Susan, Anthony, and Frederick Douglass. They were best friends for 50 years. And maybe it was that one. There were some things that we just couldn't find. And so I just was flat out, hey, here I just made some assumptions. So I think that's okay as long as everybody fesses up and we know it.
I think it's wonderful if you fess up.
Yes.
Suzanne, we've now talked for 50 minutes and time has flown by. I want to have you again in a few months. So what I want to ask is what I haven't asked you, and some advice for aspiring authors that we haven't mentioned already.
Yes. Okay. Well, definitely get in a critique group. We're not talking about your mother or your child here. We're talking about other writers. All my critique groups, we're all unpublished. You don't need big famous, you know, but people who are walking this same journey with you, trying to do this same craft, and they don't even have to be in your same genre. My current critique group, some of us, one just specializes in rhyming picture book. One is more, some do middle grade. So, but just someone, and then it's just that new fresh set of fresh eyes, because sometimes you can totally miss. I've had stories where I'm just heading down a path, my little engineering brain. And I had one where I took it to a critique group when people were howling. They were laughing. They thought what I had written was kind of absurd. They said, is this a joke? Like I had kind of missed something big that I had done that was really kind of silly. And so critique group. Also setting your...
Okay, I don't know how silly you are. I once wrote a story about a kangaroo with a pouch named Ken. And I'm a biologist. And somebody said to me, Ken has a pouch. He's the only male kangaroo in the world that ever had a pouch. The pouches are female kangaroos, Mel.
Love it. Yeah, you can. Well, with fiction, sky's the limit.
No, no, I turned her into Kenya, the kangaroo, in a second.
Oh.
You're the first person I'm admitting this to.
Okay, very well. Yeah. So critique groups are just amazing. And then also, once you've been working on something for a while, set it aside. Even if you can do it a couple months, I usually have two or three new pieces I'm working on at a time. And once I get one, that first rough draft, which is just a bear to wrestle that thing down. But once I've got that wrestled down, set it aside, come back in a month or two, boy, you can see things you didn't see before. You know, it's, of course, read current books, go to the library, go to a bookstore, read the current picture books that are out there. But I would also say, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, don't write about something you think you should write about that would be popular that kids would like. Like, let's say you think, oh, construction vehicle books are really popular. I should write a book about them. But you're not interested. You don't care. It's going to come through in your writing and also in nonfiction particularly. So only get those topics. Like I let topics simmer for a while. I always have a list of topics because I don't have enough time to write about everything I think of. But once I pick a topic, I'm going to be researching it, working on it, getting that first draft down. That'll be about 6 months off and on of work. And if it sells, I'm with that book for the rest of my life. You know, then there's, so only pick those topics. You are really fascinated. I have a book coming out later this year about the James Webb Space Telescope, the most powerful telescope ever sent into space, and which has taken these beautiful pictures like this. But space is something I'm super interested in. So this got very tedious, very detailed, very scientific engineering, but I loved every minute of it. But that's because I was fascinated about the topic. So don't do something you think you should do because it won't be any fun. I guess those are the main suggestions I would have.
And don't give up.
Oh, don't give up for sure. Okay, real quick. Astronaut Annie is a picture book I had written. Fictional tale, girl, a career day. What do you want to be when you grow up? Yeah. Kept getting rejected, 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 rejected. Put it away. I forgot about it. I literally forgot about it. Then I was doing a book signing with an illustrator. Something she said reminded, pulled it back out anyway, polished it, sold it. That book is it ended up being sent to the space station where it was read by an astronaut. Ryan Reynolds recently read it on his Bedtime Stories with Ryan. So here's something that I thought was never going to see the light of day. It was many, many decades in process, and it's had quite a little life now. And hopefully inspired a lot of little girls to go after their dreams of whatever they would want to be.
Incredible. So this is a good place to say goodbye for now. We'll be back in a few months. And awesome. Suzanne Slade, it's been wonderful to have you. How was that? It wasn't so bad, was it?
No, Mel, you're quite delightful to talk to. I got to say, you are the man.
I have to persuade my wife, but thank you very much. And I'm Mel Rosenberg, and I'm the host of the Children's Literature Channel of the New Books Network, because I love meeting and interviewing wonderful, talented people like you. So, Suzanne, thanks very much for being on the show. You're going to come out and go away and come back. And we'll say goodbye to everybody else. Listen, if run out and buy her books. Wave those new ones again so everybody can see them.
Yes. And thank you, Mel, for inviting me. This was so fun.
Thank you, Jennifer Byrne, for introducing us. Some Days Are Yellow, Behold the Octopus, and Vera Rubin's book.
Hi, Shining Star.
Shining Star. And you are the Shining Star, Suzanne Slade.
You are. Thanks, Mel.
Thanks so much. And we'll be back in a minute except for everybody else.
Right. You and I got to talk about the book we're going to write. Yeah.
Absolutely. Bye, everybody else.
Bye.
Thanks.